This is the son of PCJ.
This is PCJ Radio.
Media Network Plus, produced and presented by Paulette McQuarrie and Keith Perrell.
Well, hello, friends. It's nice to have you with us once again. Today, we have a jam-packed show as usual. Jan Hooft, the Director General of Radio Netherlands Worldwide, will join us to talk about the massive 70% cut to Radio Netherlands' budget.
One of the most respected international broadcasters is Radio Australia. Nigel Holmes, their frequency manager, will join us to talk about how Radio Australia have been able to offer a strong signal to areas outside their target area.
Broadcaster David Smith will be joining us to tell us a story involving Radio Moscow and upsetting his mother. Yes.
That'll be interesting. And we'll also have the next two winners of the PCJ Summer Shortwave Contest. We have this and more, so stay tuned. Media Network Plus, batteries not included.
First, here's Paulette with a look at some of the headlines from the world of media.
The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is funding a community radio network in Africa. It aims at breaking down linguistic barriers between rural communities while improving their communication with decision makers. The Pan-African Radio Platform pilot project connects broadcasters in Ghana, Senegal, Uganda, and Zambia to give local communities a stronger voice in national development. The Gates Foundation is funding the program through the Panos Institute of West Africa. At its launch on Friday, July 22nd, the Institute's Director General, Diana Senghor, said the project aims to improve communication between decision makers and their constituents. "I think community radio is the only means for ordinary people to have their say, especially in local governments without radio stations," she said. Arabic satellite channels have defined the story of the Arab revolutions by providing around-the-clock coverage and commentary. That hasn't happened, however, in Syria, where authorities have banned the international media. But a London-based satellite channel, Barada TV, has been able to circumvent the Syrian authorities. Australian Broadcasting Corporation correspondent Elizabeth Jackson asked Malik Al-Abda, the chief editor, how the station began.
Well, it began in late 2008 when a group of Syrians from inside Syria and also from the expatriate community decided that they really want a TV channel that expresses the people's opinions freely without any government censorship. So and I was one of the people from the beginning, and we sought funding for this new channel. We got funding and we began work on it. And then the channel was launched in April 2009.
Describe for us what your studio is like.
Very small. I mean, the number of employees we have at Barada is about 10 people and one part-timer. It's a very small setup, extremely small studio. It's a virtual studio. So it's really very, very modest. And viewers can tell when they watch us that this is a very low budget production, but we more than make up for it in terms of our content, our bravery in terms of dealing with a lot of issues relating to Syria, especially with what's happening now in the country and the revolution that's almost entering its fourth month now.
Tell me about the material that you broadcast there from that tiny studio. Do you get material from YouTube, or do the Syrians themselves somehow upload their videos directly to you?
Some of the videos are sent directly to us. Ever since we've been broadcasting a daily two-hour live show, we've had a lot of viewers. Our viewership has really skyrocketed inside the country. People watch our channel to get the news of what's happening in Syria, and also to get opinion, and also to call in. So we've got a very strong fellowship in Syria. And for that reason, people now trust us that if they send their recorded material, that it will be broadcast. So part of the footage is exclusive to us. Part of it obviously comes from YouTube, but you say it comes from YouTube, but we know who are the people who are processing these videos. These, I would say, activist news agencies now that have been set up. There's about three or four big ones. And we know the people behind them. We know who they are. I mean, we trust the footage that goes through them because they have a very high standard in terms of authenticating those videos.
That was ABC Radio National's Elizabeth Jackson speaking with Malik El Abda from Barada TV. And finally, Greece's first Macedonian language radio station will start broadcasting soon. According to representatives of the Macedonian community in Greece, a broadcasting permit has already been awarded, and it is hoped they'll be able to transmit news in Macedonian soon. The two neighboring countries, Greece and Macedonia, are locked in a long-standing dispute over the use of the word Macedonia. Greece does not officially recognize the existence of a distinct Macedonian minority on its territory.
Thank you very much, Paulette. And a special thanks goes to Andy Sennett at Radio Netherlands Worldwide at the Media Network blog for providing the stories used on today's bulletin. To find a link to them, just go to our website, www.pcjmedia.com, and you'll see a link. The next few months will be very difficult for Radio Netherlands Worldwide. Beginning in 2013, Radio Netherlands' budget will go from 46 million euros to 14 million euros. That's a cut of 70%. Editor-in-Chief Rick Renssen said, "Our country wants to be known as an important, reliable trading nation. Radio Netherlands Worldwide is contributing to this in 10 languages around the clock. Tens of millions of people all over the world consider RNW an important source of information and the Netherlands' journalistic calling card." And then he goes on to say, "Is our country really retreating behind the dikes?"
What does this mean for the future of one of the most respected international broadcasters? To answer this question and others, we are now joined with Jan Hooft, the Director General of Radio Netherlands Worldwide, in Hilversum.
You're listening to Radio Netherlands Worldwide, broadcasting via satellite and streaming audio via the web, rnw.nl.
Radio Netherlands has just been hit with a dramatic budget cut of 70%, going from 46 million euros to 14 million euros. But before we get to that, when did you find out that the Radio Netherlands budget would be reduced? Was this before the general election last year, or was it right after?
Well, technically right after, because after an election, an administration is put together, which put down their own coalition agreement, and in that coalition agreement was taken up that public broadcasting as a whole, of which the international broadcasting, i.e. RNW, is part, was to be hit by 25%. So at that point in time, this is late 2010, it was clear that there was going to be a fairly substantial cut in public broadcasting funding as part of a fairly substantial cut in all government spending, because as all countries, we also have been hit by the financial crisis. So therefore, government spending has to be reduced.
Now, just to explain to somebody who may not know, how does Radio Netherlands get its funding? Do they get their funding from one specific government department or from various different government departments?
No, in the Netherlands, until about a decade ago, knew the system of license fees, where everybody who owned a television set had to pay a license fee. And all this money was put together, and from the funds thus accumulated was paid the domestic public broadcasting, which is three television channels and five radio channels, and the international broadcasting, who by and large received about 5% of the total income. Then this license fees have been made part of taxes for efficiency reasons, and this budget was run by the Ministry of Education and Culture, and media is part of that ministry. So it was the one ministry that financed both domestic and international public broadcasting.
Now, before the big budget cut hit Radio Netherlands of 70%, Radio Netherlands had been very busy to come up with a contingency plan to reduce the budget by 20%. Which was submitted to the government. What happened to it? Did it just fall on deaf ears? Did nobody pay attention to it?
I have no clue. We haven't had a response. Well, as I said, the general cut on public broadcasting was 25%. So R&W, being professional and responsible as we are, said, okay, we'll take our share, and this is how we propose to do it. And we wrote the plan, and we submitted the plan, and we've never heard anything since. So my summary in English would be that this is more politics than policy.
Well, that actually leads me to the question then, because, you know, people around the world have been seeing a political change in the Netherlands. There's been some politicians that have said publicly that they should do away completely with Radio Netherlands. One of them is Geert Wilders. Do you really think that this cut towards Radio Netherlands was politically motivated?
Well, it was political decision making. That's all I can say. And it's not for me to discuss or even try to guess politicians' motivations. But what I do know is that it has been a political decision making process in which this has been decided among the parties that constitute the current administration. And since there is little vision behind it, or actually none whatsoever, it indeed seems to be given or caused by political motivations more than policy motivations.
Now, this cut of 70%, if speaking from a personal view, I mean, this is not a cut. This is almost like an annihilation of the service. When did you find out about this? Was it when Parliament was going to vote on this, or was the information leaked beforehand?
This is no. Lots of leaks have been happening beforehand, but they were all contradicting each other. This came out in the open basically some 5 weeks ago, 5 to 6 weeks ago, just before Parliament had to vote on it. And as part of the total 25% budget cut on public broadcasting expenditures.
But 70%, going from 46 million euros to 14 million euros, it makes me wonder, what can Radio Netherlands do? I mean, that's not just, say, 20 million euros. That's 70% of the budget.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to answer that question in detail first and foremost, because we don't have the answer yet. We will be discontinuing, which basically we propose ourselves, our tasks for Dutch-speaking people abroad, which was about 25% of the overall budget, both production and distribution. And for the remaining part, we'll have to now set up, and we are working on it as we speak, a set of criteria in terms of how do we define the criteria we need to use in order to make decisions on target subject, target areas, and target distribution platforms. Because you do know one thing. If you become as small as we seem to be becoming now, you need to focus. So as well the number of languages and regions as the number of themes and subjects we specialize in and we focus on will have to reduce compared to the current day situation. But what they will be has not been decided yet. We are working on that, and it'll take probably two more months.
Now, recently, a number of international broadcasters have had big cuts. There's been the BBC World Service, Radio Deutsche Welle, which is substantially reducing their target broadcasts overseas. And recently, the BBC said that they, you know, with the cuts that they've had, they've lost more than 18 million listeners. Is there any idea of how this will impact Radio Netherlands?
No, I can't say that yet, because we do know what we achieve now. But as I just said, we have to still make decisions on what will be our focus, both in terms of regions and languages, as in terms of subjects and content clusters in the future. So therefore, I don't know yet what will be discontinued, so I don't know yet what will be lost in terms of audience numbers.
Speaking from a personal viewpoint, I mean, Radio Netherlands has a tremendous history. It was one of the most respected international broadcasters in the world. It was up there with the BBC World Service, and Radio Netherlands is a lot smaller than the BBC World Service. From my point of view, Radio Netherlands, when I first started listening at the age of 8 in 1978, it was one of the reasons why I decided to go into international broadcasting. And I remember even some of the personalities back then, and there's many people at Radio Netherlands that I became friends with over the years, well-known announcers like the late Piet Meyers, Tom Meijer, Dodi Cowan, and others. How does this personally make you feel to see the service that has been so well-respected be hit so hard?
The fact that something was a good thing in the past does not mean it need to be kept in place just because of its history. I mean, there are no more records anymore. Everybody's doing it now differently. However, what's more important is that not so much the history, but the fact that at this day and age, this organization and its very motivated staff, who still has personalities like the ones you just mentioned, but from a next generation, makes a difference in the content and the areas they're working in and the areas they're working for. And you do see that in terms of the responses you get and the numbers you see and the replies you get on what you do and the way people now express their views on what's been happening. So this organization has its place, has its added value, and means a lot to millions and millions of people all over the world. So the mere fact that these people are sort of set in the cold, to put it like that, by our current administration, that really hurts me, and that hurts me more than the fact that we have a great history, because history, just a great history, is not enough for a great future. But the fact that nowadays we still play that role, we add that value, and we mean so much to so many people, that's the reason why this should not have happened, and that's the reason why it's a bad thing, and I'm really hurt by it.
If we take radio in other countries, say Canada or the United States or Britain, in the Netherlands, how do politicians view Radio Netherlands? Do they just view it as the international service they're talking to people outside the Netherlands, and we don't really care?
Well, those are two questions at the same time. The first has to do with what do they know, and more people know R&W for its Dutch broadcasts because they have used them or have listened to them or have even seen them through our international television service, than about the other languages. But the politicians that deal with R&W, the ones that are responsible for the decisions, are very well aware of what R&W is doing nowadays and what is achieving. So by no means it's caused by a lack of knowledge or misinformation. It's a political priority. And what you see nowadays, certainly in this country, is that the focus is a lot more inward than outward.
Since the new budget's going to be kicking in 2013, is there anything that could be done now? Can this decision be reversed, or can alternative funding be found to at least not make it have an impact like it has had?
That is, again, two questions, but the first part of it is relatively unlikely to get this decision reversed or whatever. And of course, administration may fall tomorrow over whatever little political issue. But at this point in time, that is in this country fairly unlikely for electoral reasons, because the current administration would not have a majority if there were to be elections right now. So therefore, they will make sure that they keep together. The second one is additional funding. What we will be doing is, as I just said, we'll set up a set of criteria in order to define what free speech, because that's our core mission, free speech, independent journalistic information, what that is, how we see that, and to what kind of choices that leads and decisions in terms of what we do, as I said, in terms of content areas and so forth. After that has been clear, the core of the organization will be there, and then there will be at least the opportunity, and we will look into it, whether or not additional funding, be it public, be it private, or additional partners, be it public, be it private, are an option, to see whether we can do more by creating more resources. But that, I don't want to paint rosy pictures, by no means will be to the extent where we are now or even half of it. So not on a large scale would be the short answer.
Last week I had a chance to speak to one of the former directors of Radio Canada International, who had to announce major cuts in 1992. And he told me, for him, that was the most difficult time being at the international service, not just from a professional point of view, but from a personal point of view. How about yourself? How are you personally dealing with this?
No, of course this is the most difficult, because what it does is, you know, that these people do a great job. They have, and I'm talking about my colleagues, they have impact. You mean a lot of things to a lot of people all over the world. And it's in terms of political decision making and for political reasons, and not for policy reasons, for political reasons, internal domestic political reasons, it's abolished for three-fourths of it. That is most unfair. And it is indeed, so I can fully agree with my former RCI colleague, the hardest time, because it's unfair, unnecessary, and undeserved.
What was the response that you had from listeners around the world when it was announced that the budget would be slashed by 70%?
Mostly surprise, also anger to a certain extent, and a lot of reactions by, of course, what does it mean in detail? Because we don't know yet what will be the future organization. It's not that we're going to cut one or two languages. We do have to sort of develop from scratch, zero base, so to speak, a new organization. So for some of the audience, it's not clear yet whether the content or the programs or whatever they are using or consuming will be there. But surprise and anger would be the most reactions from the audience.
And what about the support that you had when the members of parliament were meeting to discuss this? There must have been an outcry of people around the world that probably you would never have heard of before until this.
Yeah, but we have the current administration has a one seat majority in parliament, and everything they decide is pretty much pre-cooked. There's no real discussion in parliament. So once they have made their political decisions, they hold each other very firmly in order to stay in power. Outcries from wherever, be it internally, intern from the Netherlands or externally from the Netherlands or wherever, have at this point in time very little effect on policies and on political outcomes.
Do you think that if the political situation in the Netherlands was different, meaning there was a government that had a majority government, the outcome would have been different, or is that too difficult to answer?
Well, that probably depends on what the majority government would be comprised of.
So I take it next, you're going to be coming up with a contingency plan to what's going to happen over the next 2 months. Is there any areas that are priority to not cutting?
Well, we as I said, what we'll do also in order to have a clear policy and an explainable policy and a policy that is not just the preference of my editor-in-chief or myself or any other of the senior staff, we will be drawing up a set of criteria, and by using those criteria, we prioritize the content clusters, the subject, so you want, the themes, if you want to, the target areas and languages and distribution platforms we will be using. So there's no priority area at this point in time. We will do the process really step by step to make sure it is explainable, to make sure it is quantifiable, to make sure it's objectifiable.
That was Jan Hooked, the Director General of Radio Netherlands Worldwide, speaking to us from Hilversum in the Netherlands. Now let's turn our attention to our mailbag and announce the next two winners of the PCJ Summer Contest. Before we get to the winners, let's take a look at some of the answers to our question, "What does radio mean to you?" Mrs. Kaniz Fatima in Pakistan wrote, "Radio is a technology that allows the transmission of signals by modulation of electromagnetic waves with frequencies below those of light. There was a time when radio was considered an information technology, but with the invention of computer and television, radio loses its importance. Now, for the new generations, radio is just an instrument which has no significance. In spite of that, there are some valuable people like you who are devoting their lives for the development of radio." Charles Harlech in the United States wrote, "I have grown up with radio since I was a child. Besides listening to my favorite programs, I would use the air holes in the back of the radio to hide the awful-tasting pills I would receive from my parents to alleviate fevers. When I was in my early teens, I received my first shortwave receiver as a birthday gift. I would proudly proclaim to my parents that I heard a new country. I would also try to stay up late to hear unusual stations. I suppose radio has been like a great friendship. Something's changing, but thankfully the essence of radio has remained the same.
Another email that we have here came from our good friend Leonardo Santiago, who lives in Venezuela. The question, of course, that we had for all our listeners is, what does radio mean to you? His email is quite lengthy, but then at the end he says, many people in poor countries cannot access the internet, but yet shortwave and local AM radio and FM radio can get through and is a great way to provide entertainment and information. And that was from our good friend Leonardo Santiago. You know, Paulette, we've been getting, of course, a lot of people that have been writing in by snail mail.
Mm-hmm.
And not too long ago, just a few weeks ago, I was informed by a couple of listeners, actually, in Pakistan, that they started a PCJ listening club.
Oh, wasn't that neat?
One of the letters we got was from Mohammed Yunus in Pakistan, who's part of the PCJ Listening Club. And for him, Paulette, the essence of his letter is that it's a great way to travel around the world, have discussions with other people that listen to international broadcasting, and make new friends. And that was from Mohammed Yunus in Pakistan. Now, here's a promo that you've probably heard already. PCJ Radio would like to make you a winner. PCJ Radio is giving away three Texan 920 World Band receivers to three lucky winners in June, July, and August. In September, we are having a grand giveaway of a brand new Sanjen ATS-909X worth $399 to one lucky winner. To enter, let us know how you heard this program with the date and time. And answer the following very simple question. What does radio mean to you? You can send your entries to ats909x@gmail.com. Again, that's ats909x@gmail.com. If you wish to enter by snail mail and receive a small thank you gift for entering, you can find our postal address at www.pcjmedia.com. Winners will be announced on a monthly basis on Media Network Plus. So, good luck! Well, that was a promo that many of you have heard on various PCJ programs talking about the contest. Well, I think now we should announce the next two winners, and they are...
Andrew Tett in the United Kingdom.
And Garish Chandaga, who lives in India. So both of you will be contacted by us by email very soon, so we can confirm your address, and we'll be sending out those receivers to you very shortly. And of course, you'll be moving on to the grand prize draw that we will have in the month of September for a brand new Sanjen ATS-909X. Well, we now go on to radio stories. And a lot of people have some interesting radio stories. It can either be the first thing that they heard on the radio or a request that they had played where the announcer, being us, would mispronounce their names, which is something actually I do quite frequently. Many years ago, when I was at Radio Canada International, one of the guys that was working there is David Smith. He's been in broadcasting for many years. And David told me a story in the corridor that is something that I will never, ever forget. In fact, I recorded him saying it, but lost the tape.
No.
Well, that's not a big problem, because Jonathan Marks of the Critical Distance website, which you can find a link to for this show, caught up with him in South Africa to tell the story again. Now, I'm not going to give the plot away, but it involves Radio Moscow and his mother.
I listened to all kinds of radio. I was 9 years old at the time, and like any shortwave fanatic, you know, I scanned. In fact, it was before scan. They were only analog radios, no digital. So, you know, I'd search the band for whatever I could find. And Radio Moscow had a program that I particularly liked as a 9-year-old, because geography was my favorite subject at school. And on Wednesdays on Radio Moscow, they had a program called Round About the Soviet Union. And every Wednesday, that program would describe geographically a region of the USSR. So I found that very interesting, you know. But, you know, for people who wondered why I listened to Radio Moscow, I also listened to Radio Tirana, I listened to the VOA, I listened to Radio Havana, Cuba, I listened to KOL Israel, I listened to everything I could find. But let's talk about Radio Moscow. I listened regularly, and my mother, whose family comes from the former Soviet Union, and I should make it even clearer, left when the former Soviet Union came into existence, because they weren't exactly on the winning side in 1917. She didn't like the idea of me listening to Radio Moscow. And I don't want to embarrass my mother. I guess I already have, as this story will illustrate. She was nervous. She thought that anything regarding communism and people in North America, especially who came from that part of the world, would lead to the Mounties, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, having a file on those people. So she came into my room one day where I listened to the radio and said, David, don't listen to that, because the Mounties have a file on us. And she truly was nervous about this. This was a long time ago. This was 1969. She told me I couldn't listen to Radio Moscow, so of course I had to. But I had to find a way to solve the problem, to bring my mother on board. So I did what any shortwave listener does. I wrote to Radio Moscow, and I wrote to them and said, "Dear Radio Moscow, Moscow mailbag, I'm having a problem with my mother. Can you help? She doesn't want me listening to Radio Moscow because she thinks we'll get into some kind of trouble with the local authorities." I'm sure the language I used was much simpler than that. But anyway, I wrote them, and I'm sure this is the kind of letter they love getting in Moscow, because they answered, as they always did. They always answered. They sent a letter back to me and said, "Dear David, please ask your mother to be by the radio at such and such a time on such and such a day." Okay, and without telling my mother why, I invited her into my room where the radio was at the designated time, turned on the radio, and there was Vladimir Posner. And, Radio Moscow listeners and people who watch Russia Today will know who Vladimir Posner is. A lot of Americans know him because he was on a popular American talk show for a while. In any case, Vladimir Posner had an answer to my question for my mother, and he said her name on the air, and he said, "Please don't worry about your son, David, listening to Radio Moscow." And he gave our address and names, and I saw my mother changing color, red, green, white. She was terrified, angry. But he continued delivering his message. He said, "You know, the USSR and Canada are two great northern countries. We've got a lot in common, and we work together to create the better life for all," and the usual sort of stuff. And all very positive, you know, it's nation building, friendship building in the north. And my mother was so angry when this was over. "You will never listen to that radio in this house again. We're in big trouble." And that's when I discovered headphones.
And that was David Smith talking about how he discovered headphones and how his mother was changing colors when she heard her name announced on Radio Moscow. Paulette?
Many listeners in North America are familiar with 9580 kilohertz. Now, Australia is, in every sense of the word, down under. So how have they been able to reach areas of the world they don't target with their programs? Radio Australia mainly targets the Asia-Pacific. Nigel Holmes has been with RA for many years and is the frequency manager. So we called him up at RA Studios in Melbourne to talk about how RA reaches areas it does not broadcast to.
Asia and the Pacific. You're listening to Radio Australia.
Radio Australia, 24 hours a day in English, and also in Chinese.
这里是澳洲广播电台 Radio Australia.
Indonesian. Saudara sedang mendengarkan siaran dari Radio Australia. Khmer.
Message from late about the show Australia. Nombor update 56.
Pigeon. Welcome now. Long talk is in broadcast. Become long Radio Australia. And Vietnamese.
Quý vị đang nghe chương trình của đài phát thanh quốc tế.
For tuning and program guides, go to abc.net.au/ra.
How has Radio Australia been able to reach an audience in areas that they don't target? For example, I remember when I first heard Radio Australia many years ago when I was still living in Canada. I still remember the frequency. It was 9580. There's people that I know now who say that 9580 still comes in super clear. It even comes in clearer than stations broadcasting from Europe to North America. How do you do it?
Well, that one is a little bit hard to explain because in the first instance, it's a broadcast aimed to Radio Australia's audiences in the Pacific. It's an evening transmission, so it goes out around about 08 UT through until about 1400 UT. And, of course, once you unleash your shortwave signal, it doesn't stop. Once it's serviced the target area, it keeps on going until physics takes over. It's always propagated well from Shepparton in southeast Australia, travelling northwest across the Pacific Ocean into North America. It's always worked well throughout the solar cycle. Being an evening transmission, I think, gives it some measure of resilience against solar activity fluctuations. Normally, when you're shooting out... did I say northwest? I did. I meant northeast, of course, from Shepparton into North America. Normally, when you're shooting into the east, you run into problems, particularly in the morning. Broadcasting into the rising sun is the most difficult aspect for broadcasting. But for our evening broadcasts, the propagation loss seems to be quite low. And it's a clear channel. A clear channel is probably 90% of achieving a reliable service. More recently, we have had some problems from broadcasts within 15 or 20 kilohertz of 9580, but generally it works well. Now, some of our other broadcasts, which work pretty well, are by design. For example, most international shortwave broadcasters aim to make their signals available for about 90% of the time. So if you listened over 10 days, you'd get a good signal on 9 of those days. What I do is use a slightly higher frequency than most transmission managers would recommend, slightly higher than the various propagation programs like VOA CAP or ASAPS, the Australian modelling program, would recommend. So where they say that the optimum working frequency is, for example, 9.5 megahertz, I might use a frequency in the 25 meter band and 11 megahertz frequency. And the reason for that is twofold. First of all, you'll get slightly less propagation attenuation by using the higher frequency. And possibly more importantly, you'll get less mixed mode and multi-mode propagation. So in other words, if, for example, between Shepparton and Fiji, I could have a 2F circuit on a particular frequency or a 3F circuit on another frequency with a slightly higher takeoff angle, I would try and force a 2F mode, or what we call the first mode. The first mode is the one that has the least number of F layer ionospheric hops involved. And the reason for that is so that I don't get a multi-mode propagation where there's some 2F and some 3F coming down in the same target area. And this can happen depending on the radiation characteristics of the antenna. I try and use a frequency that, if tried to propagate on the 3F mode, which would require a higher takeoff angle, the ionosphere wouldn't sustain that 3F mode and the signal would go into outer space instead. So that subjectively improves the signal-to-noise ratio of a lot of the Radio Australia signals. What it also means, Keith, is that, and a number of listeners and other people have commented about this in the last few years, I've used frequencies quite high up in the HF spectrum, higher than people would have thought that I'd use during solar minimum and that is to basically try to force a first mode propagation path onto our signals and give us the best signal-to-noise ratio that we can do. You're quite right when you say that our Radio Australia's a long way away from a lot of these target areas. When we're broadcasting, for example, on 17750 kilohertz into Southeast Asia, and I know that's a frequency that you receive quite well in Taiwan, that signal goes out from Shepparton on about 329 degrees out to the northwest. It goes through Darwin at the top of Australia, and that's over 3,000 kilometres away. So I have to go 3,000 kilometres before I'm even out of Australia. So many of the international broadcasters would regard that as a maximum range for their broadcasts. And I'm doing this with a 100 kilowatt transmitter too, not a 250 kilowatt transmitter. So that's why I use it. I keep using that higher frequency when other broadcasters might use a 15 megahertz or a 13 megahertz frequency. I try and use the highest frequency that the path will sustain for about 85% of the time.
You see, because when I tune to 17750 kilohertz from probably around 10 o'clock in the morning local time until when it signs off at 7 hours UTC, the thing that I'm surprised about, which it mystifies me, because there's other broadcasters I know that are targeting this area, and they sound, you know, what would be the stereotypical really bad quality shortwave signal, but the Radio Australian one, most days, sounds like just as clear as any even local AM radio station. It's that clear.
Well, that's both heartening news, Keith, and also a little curious. I wonder if those other broadcasters are using optimum audio processing. At Shepparton, we've used for the past 10 or 15 years, closer to 20 years, we've used audio processors called MBL-100s. These were made by CRL, which I think was bought out by Auburn, or did Auburn get bought out by CRL? I can never quite remember. And the MBL-100s, in keeping with a lot of the modern audio processors, are quite cunning devices, and you can only use them with modern transmitters, which have DC-coupled or digital modulation systems. They provide very good processing that really increases the average power in our sidebands of our transmitters. Apart from that, the transmitters themselves, they're nothing special until 6 months or so ago. Shepparton was using transmitters that were over 30 years old and probably representing a 40-year-old design. We were using Harris Gates SW100 transmitters, which I think are early 70s design. These have pulse width modulator RF amplifiers in them, so you can use this high quality, high intensity audio processing that I was talking about. We've still got four Harris SW100A transmitters in service, but we've just recently, in the last 6 months, added three Continental transmitters to Shepparton's lineup. Two of those are second hand. They've actually come from Guam down to Darwin when the Darwin station in Australia was being operated by Christian Voice, and then when Christian Voice moved out of Darwin, our transmission contractor picked up those two transmitters, and there's a third brand spanking new Continental there. So the seven transmitters at Shepparton, still 100 kilowatts, but we make those 100 kilowatts work very hard.
Now, Radio Australia for the Asia-Pacific region, Radio Australia has a very big responsibility because for many countries in the Asia-Pacific and also Southeast Asia, it's one of the main news sources, which has been the main target audience. Now, let's say you take Asia-Pacific, which is a very large area. What percentage of, let's say, depending on where you are, still listen on traditional HF?
That's a good question. It's quite topical because I'm sure your listeners would be aware that the other international broadcasters such as Deutsche Welle and BBC World Service have been reducing their shortwave broadcasts in recent years. But if you look at where they're keeping those shortwave transmissions, they're into countries where it's still a perfectly valid and very viable medium. And so it is with Radio Australia's shortwave services targeted into the West Pacific, Papua New Guinea, and the southwest and south central Pacific, from Solomon Islands, Vanuatu, Fiji, Samoa and Cooks. In those countries, Radio Australia has established FM transmitters. So we have our own small FM transmitters, about 20 of them so far, ranging in power from 300 watts to a kilowatt, and we feed those via satellite. And the satellite service itself is available to listeners if they want to invest in a C-band downlink facility. But we find that our shortwave service still has a very big audience. A couple of reasons for that. Some of these countries still have their domestic services carried on shortwave. Vanuatu recently refurbished its shortwave transmitters and has now restored a 3 megahertz frequency during the evening and a 7 megahertz frequency for daytime broadcasts. And that's the most economic way that some of these Pacific Island communities can cover the broadly distributed islands that make up their countries. Another reason why shortwave is still important to us is that even places like Fiji, where we have had FM transmitters in Nandi and in Suva, those transmitters were turned off at gunpoint about 18 months ago. And so, of course, shortwave is now the predominant vehicle for those areas who want to listen to impartial news and current affairs. Indeed, of course, once you're beyond the 30 or 40 kilometre range of the FM transmitter, then you're still looking at either Radio Australia on shortwave or via satellite.
You know, last summer I spent 2 weeks in West Java in Indonesia, and I was staying in this small community which was really cut off from everywhere. At nighttime, the power grid went off at around 7 o'clock in the evening and returned the following morning around 8 or 9 o'clock, if it had returned at all. So it was pitch black, and I remember in this small little, I wouldn't even call it a hotel, it was somebody's house who they were renting out a room where I was staying for 2 weeks. I got a knock at my door at around 9 o'clock in the evening, and there was a gentleman standing there, and he said to me, where are you from? I said, well, I'm from here. And he said, oh, interesting. And we started talking, and I asked him, I said, where did you learn your English from? He said, oh, I listen to the BBC, VOA, and Radio Australia. And I said, oh, so you listen to international broadcasting? And he says, well, actually, I only listen when I have electricity, but now I have a little solar panel that I can use to charge my batteries. So the following day, he invited me off to his village, and it was a very small village, maybe around 50, 60 people. And every night, a large percentage of the village would gather around this old Telefunken radio that they got maybe 40 years ago, and they would listen to various international broadcasters, not just in English, but also in Indonesian. And they would be tuning in to listen to not just what was going on in Indonesia, but also to what was going on in the rest of the world. And when I saw that, and I spent time there, I said to myself, you know, it would be nice if I can have some people from the BBC, Deutsche Welle, Radio Nederland, who's also having a massive cut of 70%, the Voice of America with me to see this. Because these are listeners who, first of all, they're not going to write, because to write a letter is very expensive to mail it, and they also don't have access to the internet.
The broadcasters you mentioned, Keith, are well aware of audiences like you've described there, and indeed they were the audiences that those broadcasters targeted a few years ago. But now, for better or worse, most of the world's leading international broadcasters target the strata that they call the potential shakers and movers, the potential leaders. So they'll be more interested in directing their programs towards university students via online or through local FM rebroadcasts with partner ship stations, podcasts, whatever you like. Now, those small village audience groups are quite low down on the scale. And in fact, in some broadcasters' minds, you know, they're off the radar. They don't target those sort of groups any longer. But as you say, there's still often a need for that. We know that, for example, in Papua New Guinea, the national broadcaster in that country has difficulties maintaining its infrastructure. It's often plagued by loss of power when generators break down. There's a problem maintaining the security of remote radio sites, which can be vandalised or otherwise damaged. There's issues keeping up funding to pay salaries for program staff, to pay power bills. A whole pile of issues conspire against the provision of the country's the operation of the country's own national broadcaster. And we find that to a lesser extent in some other countries. As I say, where the countries have some residual shortwave domestic service, we find we have a very good listenership to Radio Australia's transmissions. And just harking back to the comment I made about international broadcasters identifying particular groups, I think it's expedient for these broadcasters to say, oh yes, we're targeting the up-and-coming, the leaders of the future in pick a country, in Africa or Southeast Asia, and they'll more and more put their efforts into providing broadcasts in English on the basis that these people would be learning English, and that they, indeed, some of them, we do know from our audience surveys that the more affluent listeners seek out English broadcasts. And, of course, this is at the expense of producing Radio Netherlands. I don't know if they're going to keep a broadcast production capacity in Indonesian. But Radio Netherlands and Radio Australia always had friendly rivalry with broadcasts in Indonesian to Indonesia. And both broadcasts were well regarded. Of course, it looks like it's going to become a one-horse race now. Radio Australia will certainly be keeping Indonesian in our lineup. In fact, in recent months, we've expanded our services. We've added Burmese to our lineup. We're looking at other languages other than English for both online, satellite, and shortwave broadcasts. I think now we are running 144 hours of shortwave transmission per day out of Shepparton. We've got other broadcasts on shortwave from contractors overseas outside Australia where we contract short duration transmissions. In all, we're probably running about 180 hours per day of shortwave transmission. And we'll keep that at a particular level because it's working for us into those markets that we're trying to access in the Asia-Pacific region. So you can reassure that village in West Java with the 40-year-old Telefunken, and there's nothing wrong with a 40-year-old Telefunken, a well-engineered radio, I'm sure. And whether it's using germanium or silicon transistors, I'm sure it's quite economical on battery drain too. You can assure that village that they'll still be able to listen to Radio Australia in English or Indonesian.
In South Australia I was born, heave away, haul away, in South Australia, round Cape Horn, bound for South Australia.
And I was speaking there with Nigel Holmes from Radio Australia. Actually, Nigel and I, we had a very lengthy conversation, and we will bring you more of that interview in an upcoming edition of the program. Now, Paulette, we actually have some really, really, I should say, really, 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 really big news to announce, right?
Yes, really, really, really big.
That's right. Many of you have been writing us suggesting that Media Network Plus become a weekly show. Well, to make it a weekly show at 55 minutes would be, we have so many other things that we're doing, we just wouldn't have the time. But we will be able to offer a weekly 30-minute edition plus the 55-minute edition beginning July 30th, and it will be airing on the World Radio Network.
That's right. It'll be airing Saturdays to Africa and Asia from 10 to 10:30 UTC, to Europe from 13 to 13:30 UTC, and to North America from 21 to 21:30 UTC. That's beginning July 30th.
And that's going to be on the World Radio Network. Well, the satellites are, to North America will be on the Galaxy 19 satellite, to Europe the Eutelsat Hotbird 6 satellite, to Asia Pacific and Africa on the Intelsat 10 satellite. And listeners in the United States and Canada will be able to listen on Sirius XM satellite radio, and the channel for that is 120/120. Listeners in the United Kingdom, as well as in other parts of Europe, will be able to listen on the Sky Digital channel 120/120. 22. That's 122. You can find out all that information at our website, www.pcjmedia.com. That's pcjmedia.com. And the weekly 30-minute edition, like we just said, will begin July 30th. So, in fact, this weekend.
So, with that, I'm Paulette McQuarrie in Vancouver, Canada.
And I'm Keith Powell in Taipei, Taiwan.
Hoping you'll join us again soon.
So until next time, 73s.
And 88s to the ladies.